suggest we get started. My name is David Mazenbring. The series of sessions I'm doing over this week and into next week is called Blind Spots Among Fools for Christ. And the first one was on maritime ministry, which is a blind spot for at least the American church, serving people who work at sea, seafarers, invisible workers. And then we had two or three sessions on the situation in Israel-Palestine. Yesterday talked about mission theology. And today, one of my favorite subjects, what's wrong with charity? Although actually I think the session is called Goodwill is Not Good Enough, or something like that. And I'm going to make extensive reference to a book by Garrett Keyser, but I'm really not sure I'm spelling his name right. It's called Help, the Original Human Dilemma. And you'll hear several quotes coming from that book. The book is, I hope, on the lake at this moment. On its way up to the village. Maybe it'll get to the bookstore this afternoon. And we'll be there over the next... We'll be there for you to pick up or go home and order it if you like the quotes you hear from it. I'll start with two. One, two. Caesar says, help cuts about as close to the bone of what it means to be human as any subject I can think of. We are creatures who require a lot of help. And I can tell you, he's not just talking about, when he says we require a lot of help, he's not just talking about getting help. He's talking about being a helper. And the whole book is full of all the ambiguities of who gets help the most when help is being exchanged or undertaken. Our ability to give and receive help may be the best alternative for defining humankind. He thinks it's that essential to humanness. Now, I want to start by asking you just to imagine, bring to mind, you know, if it helps, close your eyes, but you don't have to. Bring to mind your favorite charity. Just exclude your religious congregation for the moment. I mean, in the eyes of the IRS, it is a charity, but leave it beside, because that's your religious congregation is a little more complicated. Bring to mind your favorite charity. Yeah. You don't have to say it. Just keep it in mind, all right? Everybody, get one in mind and list two or three accomplishments that are the reason you favor it, you love it. What does it do that you like? This is a mental exercise. Just bring it in mind. All right, you got your charity, you got two or three things it does you really like. How do you know it does that? Garrett Keyser says, feeling good about what you're doing is no guarantee that you're doing any good. Feeling good about what you're doing is no guarantee that you're doing any good. How often has your favorite charity taken pains to explain to you what they are not accomplishing? Unless it's to make the case that they could if you had given more money. I'm not going to do it today for lack of time, but I have, in a course I taught at St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle where I worked, when we have more time, more sessions here, I actually made lists of what the charity that my wife Maria and I established in Florida among merchant seafarers, people who work on the ships. I spent 15 years building up that charity and trying to get people involved, volunteers and funders, et cetera, et cetera. And then only when I left the charity was I willing to write down in a list and then voice all the things that we didn't accomplish. So I'm not going to do that one because I found a better way to get into that issue, I think. There's a guy named Mark Wynn who spent 25 years building up food banks in the state of Connecticut. Based in Hartford, Connecticut, his organization has reached great heights under his leadership. And after he left as the director, he published in the Washington Post last November, the Sunday Washington Post op-ed, Sunday before Thanksgiving. He did a piece that I'm going to quote from extensively. It's called, "When Handouts Keep Coming, the Food Line Never Ends." Now keep in mind, we're getting into this subject by quoting charity leaders who will tell you things after they leave the charity that they won't tell you when it's their job to promote the charity, right? And listen to what this guy who devoted 25 years of his professional life to building up food banks says. It says 35 million Americans are in line at soup kitchens, food banks, and food stamps offices nationwide. There are tens of thousands of emergency food sites. This is a huge, far-flung network of emergency food programs in the United States that constitutes one of the largest charitable institutions in the nation. It's a powerful force in shaping popular perceptions of domestic hunger and other forms of need. But, he writes, one of its most lasting effects has been to sidetrack efforts to eradicate hunger and the root cause, poverty. And then he quotes a book called Sweet Charity that I haven't read, but I would like to, by Janet Poppendieck, that I'll bet he didn't quote much when he was raising money for his charity. She's a sociologist, and in her book, he says, she made it clear that there's something in the food banking culture and its relationship with donors that dampens the desire to empower the poor and take a more muscular public stand against hunger. Over 25 years, the food bank that he directed leapfrogged five times from one set of facilities to another, until it had this massive, has today, a massive warehouse that is a state-of-the-art facility, the equal of most commercial food distribution centers in the country. He said the volunteers multiplied to 3,000 because the donations of food, much of it unfit for human consumption, required many hands for sorting and discarding. The number of food distribution sites skyrocketed from 5 in 1982 to 360 today. So this is a successful food bank executive. Quote, "The overall futility of the effort became evident to me one summer day in 2003 when I observed a food bank truck pull up to a low-income housing project in Hartford." And he talks about how the truck pulled up and the lines happened and the volunteers felt really good about what they were doing. And he said, no one made any attempt to determine whether the recipients actually needed the food, nor to encourage the recipients to seek other forms of assistance like food stamps. The food distribution was an unequivocal act of faith based on the generally accepted knowledge that this neighborhood was a known area of need. The recipients seemed reasonably grateful, but the staff members and volunteers seemed even happier. Both parties were trapped in an ever expanding web of immediate gratification that offered the recipients no long-term hope of eventually achieving independence and self-reliance. As the food bank's director told me later, the more you provide, the more demand there is. Now don't get discouraged. It's not all going to be negative. We just got to make our case here from the beginning. My experience of 25 years in the food banking has led me to conclude that codependency within the system is multifaceted. And then he lays out three ways, three types. As a system that depends on donated goods, it must curry favor with the nation's food industry, which often regards food banks as a waste management tool. He doesn't say this, but I will add, that is, by the way, a good source of tax deduction. Okay, what you donate on a daily basis to the local food bank because you can't sell it anymore, you can take as a tax credit. Secondly, second form of codependence, it requires an army of volunteers who themselves are dependent on the carefully nurtured belief that they're doing good by feeding the hungry. That's a second form of codependence with the food industry, with the volunteers. And thirdly, he said the capital campaigns require that we maintain to raise the capital money to go from one size warehouse to an even bigger one, requires that we maintain a ready supply of well-heeled philanthropists and captains of industry to raise the dollars and public awareness necessary to make the next warehouse expansion possible. Now he's coming toward his conclusions. Food banks have an ability to attract volunteers and to raise money that approaches that of major hospitals and universities. While none of this is inherently wrong, it does distract the public and policymakers from the task of harnessing the political will needed to end hunger. And then finally, his punchline, the risk is that the multi-billion dollar system of food banking has become such a pervasive force in the anti-hunger world and so tied to its donors and volunteers that it cannot step back and ask if this is the best way to end hunger, food insecurity, and the root cause, poverty. And then he goes on to say, what if we marshaled all these volunteers and all these community leaders into an advocacy effort to end, to eliminate the poverty that feeds the hunger? But we're so busy delivering the food today to an ever-expanding lines of people who take it that we never get around to that task. Kaiser, Garrett Kaiser says, the clarity that comes with an opportunity to help can amount to a dangerous distraction. The clarity that comes with an opportunity to help can amount to a dangerous distraction, sometimes from the very responsibilities that want our help the most. I have a few copies of these quotes that I'm reading in more. So if you struggle to get them down and you want one, see me after. Is the way we approach social problems perhaps part of the reason they persist? That's the provocative question we're wrestling with here. Is the way we approach problems part of the reason they persist? Are we better at solving our consciences in how we address the problems than at really addressing the root causes of the problem? Kaiser says, you could say that help is a social act often necessitated by our failure to be authentically social. Social help is an act necessitated by our failure to be really social in an authentic way in our communities. One of my favorite quotes, and with apologies to those of you at St. Mark's who have heard me already use this quote a million times, I'll give you a little bit bigger context. My favorite novelist is Chinua Achebe, who 50 years ago wrote Things Fall Apart, copies of which are available in the bookstore we talked about yesterday. And his current novel, which was published in about 91, I think, it's called Anthills of the Savannah. And in it, I'm going to read you a little story. I just love it. The protagonist is this iconoclastic journalist who, and the little episode that I will read to you comes from the, well, it reads like this. A couple of months ago, he, being the protagonist, had been persuaded against his normal inclination to speak at the Bassa Rotary Club. Bassa is the fictional name of this town in West Africa. So he normally would refuse such invitations, but he agreed to go speak at their weekly luncheon. On that particular occasion, the club had more cause than usual to be happy with itself, for it had just bought and donated a water tanker to a dispensary or a clinic in one of the poorest districts of North Bassa, an area that has never had electricity nor pipe-borne water. I love the next phrase. In the after-dinner haze of good works, cigar smoke, and liqueur, his host sat back to hear what their distinguished guest had to tell them. Well, as usual, he, the protagonist, left what he should have told them and launched into something quite unexpected. "Charity," he thundered, "is the opium of the privileged." That's the phrase you've heard at St. Mark's. "Charity is the opium of the privileged. From the good citizen who habitually drops 10 cents from his loose change and from a safe height above the bowl of the leper outside the supermarket, to the group of good citizens like yourselves who donate water so that some Lazarus in the slums can have a syringe boiled clean as a whistle for his jab and his sores dressed more hygienically than the rest of him. To the Band-Aid stars that lit up so dramatically the dark Christmas skies of Ethiopia. While we do our good works, let us not forget that the real solution lies in a world in which charity will have become unnecessary." All right, now don't lose hope. This is not going to be all negative here. We're going to get to the positive. But we've got to start by acknowledging that that charity is a sacred cow for us. It appears that there's some, I came across some scientific basis for why we love it so much. Listen to this. In a recent study at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, the subjects were given some money and told they could donate it anonymously to any range of charities. Using magnetic resonance imaging to map the activity of various parts of the subjects' brains, the researchers were able to examine what went on inside each person's head as they made decisions based on moral beliefs. They found that the part of the brain that was active when a person donated happened to be the brain's forward center, the mesolimbic pathway, responsible for doling out the dopamine-mediated euphoria associated with sex, money, food, and drugs. This is powerful stuff. Thus, the warm glow that accompanies charitable giving. You can measure it. Donating also engaged the part of the brain that plays a role in the bonding behavior between mother and child and in romantic love. This involves oxytocin, a hormone that increases trust and cooperation. This is why it's such a sacred cow. It makes us feel really good. But keep in mind what Kieser says. Feeling good is no guarantee that you're doing good. Feeling good about what you're doing is no guarantee that you're doing any good. He's just a poet in the way he writes. I love it. Steve Biko was a South African student leader against apartheid, a profound thinker. Copies of his book are also, I hope, up on the lake or getting close to it. We'll be here in a few days. In a week from this morning, I'll do a session on the book and his writings. Biko had a very strong critique. He's the father of black consciousness in South Africa under apartheid. He's a black leader. And when he launched his movement of black consciousness, the people who took great exception to him were not the conservative white Afrikaners. It was the English-speaking white liberals. They're the ones who really had trouble with this young new leader's philosophy of black consciousness. And Biko has a great critique of the white liberals who would sit around wringing their hands about how awful apartheid was and would come into the black community and do acts of charity and then go back to their homes. And at the end of the day, the system never really changed. But the white liberals felt better about themselves. So Biko has a very, I've learned so much about my role in the world from an essay he wrote called "Black Souls in White Skins?" Borrowing a phrase from Frantz Fanon, the Algerian psychologist who was very critical of French colonialism. Biko said, "Are they really our best friends? Or are they just taking care of themselves? Is there a difference between their stated intentions and their subconscious motives?" This is a key point. In how we engage in charity, Do we need to tune in to the difference between what we say we're trying to do, ending hunger, and what our actual subconscious motives might be? Because he argued in South Africa that the whites had an interest in the system. They might have felt guilty about it, but basically they lived much better than they would have lived if there was universal right to vote and they were outnumbered 10 to 1 by black voters.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So is his point that they lived better because of the social structure, or they lived better because they felt good about the charity or the...
Well, I think he would say best, but the point really is the social structure gave them at least an unconscious interest in maintaining it. And he would argue, as I will, that our economic interests are very powerful bias. It is very hard to actually operate in a manner that counters your economic interests, unless you take a short-term version and somebody sells you that your interest is doing X when in fact it isn't. You know, I can't help referencing whether the tremendous national debt we have acquired in the last few years has made us safer or promoted the recruitment of terrorism. You know, I mean, that's not the subject of this discussion. But for example, so you can be deluded in what your economic interests are, but to the degree you have interests, you tend at least unconsciously to try and act in a way that protects them. And so he would say white liberals had an interest in an apartheid system that reserved the best schools and the best jobs and the best homes for them, and they acted in a way that tried to keep it. Yes?
I think this author and perhaps yourself have assumed that the object of food banks and feeding the hungry today is to end hunger. I think perhaps the goal that I work under is to end hunger today for these specific
people right now.
There's a different set of goals there.
That's right. And I'm not gonna say we shouldn't do charity. I think we should do it. But I think his point actually was that the action and the way in which we marshal huge forces, because he said this is a big operation in this country now. If you take all the feeding programs combined, it's a lot of people, it's a lot of resources, and it can become a distraction from the cause of actually ending hunger.
But I don't think he would vote for ending feeding people today.
He would
for
not.
Hoping that we can end hunger.
He would not. He would say,
years.
let it not distract us from the real task.
John Kennedy said he was going to end, his term was going to end hunger in the United States. We had the potential for ending hunger.
And maybe Mark Wynne would say we got distracted, or we're being distracted from that larger task.
It seems like the problem is, as you're expressing it, that we're sapping our consciences and we're distracting ourselves from actions that could actually affect our goal, our intended goal. The other piece of this that he may or may not include, and I think should be included, is the unintended consequences of our actions. In this case, the moral hazard. The hazard that the people who can simply receive the charitable acts are no longer incentivized to act on their own behalf.
Good point. Now, Kaiser says, from this book, Help. Keep in mind what I just said. Bickel's argument is that our stated intentions aren't necessarily consonant, the same as our subconscious motives. Kaiser says, quote, "To help another person toward greater self-determination is sooner or later to give that person power over your self-determination." Think about the South African context again. To help another, for whites to help blacks actually achieve self-determination, instead of being the objects of our charity, to actually be powerful enough to control their own destiny, Kaiser says, is sooner or later to give them some power over my self-determination.
So now charity is not only useless and a distraction, and perhaps a moral hazard, but it's also subjugation?
Is charity subjugation? No, I would say it's a distraction from the process of of freeing people. It can be a fact. Now, you know, to go back to your point, let me not pretend to be holier than thou here. One of the ministries that I work hard on leading at St. Mark's is a feeding scheme, you know. And it goes out, and once a month it cooks and feeds 100 homeless teenagers. And once a month it cooks and feeds 300 homeless men. And we have a homeless, mentally ill woman's shelter in our church basement every night of the year. So I believe we need to do this stuff, and that we're called to as Christians. But I think we can do it. My point of being here is we can do this a little more self-aware of what are the distracting pitfalls. And what are, and to just be honest with what we're not accomplishing that we are also called to do. And I'm going to get to that. What else could we be doing?
Well, it also seems to me that we need to be careful about how we use the words like subjugation, because giving up some of our power is actually what's going to be required, right? And so we're not subjecting ourselves by sharing power with others. We're giving up something that we actually aren't entitled to if we're acting as real social creatures. Because if I remain entitled to having everything I have and not acting in any way, you know, other than to make myself feel good, then actually ending world hunger becomes impossible.
Yes, but now, in a world where we start, you know, from this moment going forward, of unequal distribution of power and resources, some of us have more to lose from equaling the playing field than others. And to skip ahead to where I'm going to end up, and where is that to, well, maybe it's the next point. Maybe I don't have to screw it up. I haven't done this talk before, so check my notes. Yeah, we're almost there. I like the South African context because we think it's far enough safely removed from our own interests that we're willing to look at it a little bit more objectively, right? Than if we looked at something too close to home, that then our perceptions might be colored. White South Africans who worked for the right to vote among blacks, which was key, you know, or any form of helping blacks become more self-determinant, more empowered, had to know that they were entering a situation where their influence and their privilege was going to be reduced, because there just wasn't any way that everyone in that country could live on the standard that they were living. And I would say there's no way everyone in the world can live on the standard that Americans are living. So this has important lessons for us. If Biko was right, then the implications are difficult for everyone, on the left as well as on the political right. Okay? If Biko is right that our stated intentions are not necessarily the same as our subconscious motives, and that sometimes we say we're going to help, but we actually help ourselves more, perhaps the reason we're satisfied with results that don't solve problems is that we discern God's call in communities of similar resource. Now, this is my thesis. It's a working thesis. That maybe when well-fed people are the ones making decisions about how to end hunger, we aren't motivated in the same way as we would be if the circles in which we deliberated those strategies were somehow a mixture of the fed and the hungry. Maybe, and this, those of you at St. Mark's will recognize the value of having Tent City close to us. Maybe questions about homelessness will only really find solutions when there's conversation, when the table that is deliberating those questions includes both the housed and the homeless. That some, and if those examples are true, what does it say about solving global problems in contexts that are only American thinkers? We will not get there. And when and this is this is what I'm most passionate about here, is that we cannot, we have to get away from this idea that American charities know what's best for the world, or American people, or non-charities. We need to be in a global context to find solutions to global problems. Otherwise, we're probably just making ourselves feel better and doing some good about the problems today, but getting distracted from their true resolution.
Some of those things are in progress. Yes. In the Lutheran World Service, I think it's called.
Well, I dare you to come to my session on Monday night. When I talk about, this is why I'm a bad Lutheran. I'm going to talk about...
We can forgive you, it's our job.
I have a very high regard for Lutheran World Relief, but my money goes to an ecumenical agency. Just because I think the potential is greater. That's tiny. Church World Service is tiny compared to Lutheran. Lutherans do things on a large scale, and they do it very well, but they do it as Lutherans.
What I'm saying is they are including the poor in the decisions. Poor and the hungry. Yeah,
increasingly. The best, and it's right up there with the best of the USAID agencies,
yes.
I think. And churches, so, this is another favorite subject. Why is Lutheran World Relief including the poor in their decisions? Well, I could back up and say, how do you know? That would be an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
Okay. But I believe it's true, so I'm gonna grant you that one. Why are they doing it? And I think it's because we're beginning to realize that our identity as Christians gives us access to networks that we haven't always used as well as we might. Keep in mind what I said yesterday about the cultural and church biases that were active early in the missionary movement. And we have made some progress, you know, and are less active today, but they're still latent in our gut. This one person came up to me after the session yesterday and talked about what a struggle it was for her sons to go on a youth pilgrimage recently when the group of pilgrims didn't have an agenda to help. They were going to another country, a poor, you know, country, and they didn't. And the people kept saying, well, what are you going to do there? You can't just go for a good time. You got to help those people. And these kids said, no, we're going to just go and build relationships. And the mother told me that the son has come back and he's going to leave a private high school and go to a public high school because he wants more diversity in his last 2 years of high school. Powerful. All right. So what are we going to do? Okay, now we're going to shift from trying to undermine our faith in what might not be as all-solving of the problems as we thought. If all this is true, then what do we do about it? What do we do with it? And so we're, most of us here are Christians. And we draw inspiration from Scripture. What is the Scripture story that has had more influence, more frequently involved, quoted, in charitable appeal? What story from...
Good Samaritan.
There you go. The Good Samaritan, right? More often than not, I got in trouble. I knew before then I was a bad Lutheran, but I especially knew I was a bad Lutheran when working within my synod, Florida Bahama Synod, I get recruited to work as the Bible study leader on a social justice weekend training from people of different congregations. And the organizer kept saying, you got to use the Good Samaritan. That's the Bible study you should be working with, the Good Samaritan story. And I have long struggled with the Good Samaritan. I don't like it. And it was only in the course of working with it that I came to realize that the Good Samaritan is not about how to help people. It's about who is my neighbor. Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan in response to the question, who is my neighbor? And it isn't about being charitable toward the victim on the road. It's about the fact that it was the... I should have read it before I came in. The Samaritan is the one, you know, the hated Samaritan is the one who provided, who had the compassionate heart. And Jesus says, you know, go like that, be like that, cross boundaries of between the good guys and the bad guys in who your neighbor is. It's not about how to help, it's about who should be helping. I think we need a diverse context within which to address, to look for solutions to problems. I think those of us with more interest in maintaining the status quo may need to mute our voices a little bit when we get into those diverse contexts and hear from the people who have more interest in change what they think might bring it. A couple of days ago, talking about the situation in the Middle East, someone said, well, you know, how are you going to solve it? And I said, I'm not sure that that's our, being such a major contributor to the problem, I'm not sure it's our job or we should be trusted to come up with the solutions. And why bother to work on that when, you know, as Christians, we've got Palestinian Christians who really have, in my opinion, a pretty good bead on the situation. They got it figured out pretty well and are in touch with all the communities that can be, that need to be part of the solution. Secondly, there's two things we need. One, the diverse context, and secondly, the people we want to help, or we believe we are called to live better with, we're not going to really help them when we have pathetic images of them. We need positive images. Why? I mean, it's true they're suffering, they're dying, and that loosens our wallet.
You maintain the codependency. If you see them as pathetic, then you feel that they need you.
Right.
And you're invested in them becoming otherwise, because then you don't get to exercise your need.
Right.
We need the humility to see others' humanity.
Right, and we don't see their humanity when they're struggling so much. One, two, three.
They can teach us.
They can teach us.
Mine is more or less the same thing. If you see them as kind of smaller human beings than yourself, then you think that you only have something to give to the situation. It's not that you could ever learn anything.
Right, right.
I was going to say, so we're just like them, we can learn.
Guess what, Steve?
Also, I think when you insult somebody, even though innocently, it becomes a sort of a seed of inefficiency in them. It's human nature to be angry. There's a beautiful chapter in the Three Cups of Tea when the American is pulled away from the project building the school and told to sit down and shut up because the leader tells him, we've been here 600 years without a school. We can take 3 years to build this school. Stop telling us we have to build it in 3 months. Mm-hmm. Because his pushing of the work crews was making them angry and less efficient.
So, in the Holden Village publication here, well, I'm going to border on the cynical here, but I think there's a certain, is it cynical or is it realistic to say that basically we human beings operate in a self-interested manner as much as we can. So if those victims of something, you know, lack of water or hunger or homelessness, if we see them as attractive people that could teach us something, then we're more motivated to work for their empowerment, because we realize that until they are fully human, our own humanity is not going to grow.
in the direction that they can offer us. I said yesterday in that session on mission that I think the mission God calls us to is one of mutual transformation in the encounter. Missionaries have gone out to change others, but actually God calls us out into the human family, into the whole family of the created world, because we need each other. And it's only in the course of encountering each other out of an interest for what I can gain, you know, not profit by exploitation, but that my best interest is in your fullest, most authentic life. And until, I mean, what is it about, what is it within, deep within the culture of the first Christians, the Palestinians, that would inform my practice of Christianity that I will never get to appreciate, enjoy, and grow from as long as they are subjugated in the way that they are? What is it in Africa's culture that some white South Africans are beginning to discover is richly beneficial to them that they could never experience and feast on and enjoy as long as blacks were being held down by apartheid? Not that it's a perfect situation there today and blacks are, you know, fully human, or that any of us are fully human, but that we got to be, and that's what I didn't like about the Good Samaritan. That victim of being beaten up along the road has no humanity. You never heard a word from him. There was nothing drawing me toward what could be gained, what I had to gain from his wellness. And it wasn't until I really wrestled with why I didn't want to teach that Bible study that I realized it's not about how to help.
If I were that Samaritan, I would have somebody help me.
You would?
That's why I would help him.
Say that a little louder so we can hear you.
If I was the injured guy, I would like it if someone would help me. And that's why I would help him.
And then there's a good reason for being charitable, and we need to be. You know, we need to, you just, Kieser has some great quotes here. Actually, I wasn't going to use it, but I think I will. Right along those lines. This is deep. Sometimes I wonder if that won't emerge as our final indictment, after death or immediately before we die. Not that we failed to assist every paroled felon and addicted moocher who crossed our paths, but that we looked on those who were willing to assist with too cold a regard, or too pat a judgment. Not the unwashed, but the scrubbed up, our peers, the ones formed in our own sociological image, just with slightly bigger hearts. Those will be the ones we have most let down. All right, so I don't want you to get the impression by the selection of a few quotes I've brought from Kieser that he's against charitable work here. He's not. He's against believing that that's the end all of solving the world's problems. It's not. We need we should not think we're moving toward long-term solutions until those solutions are worked out in diverse circles and until we see what we have to gain from the freedom or the housing or the well-fedness of the people that we are desirous of larger community with, sharing larger community with. Yes.
So what do they think of mini grants where you're giving them an opportunity to help themselves?
Oh, you know, this is 2 days in a row that at the end of a session, someone makes the perfect commercial for the next session. You're talking about microfinance, and the people in this room who know me must just be chuckling to themselves, because that's my favorite subject, microfinance. And I will do a session on it on Thursday.
Yeah.
You won't be here. Well, but the new Holden website gives you access to the audio archive. And so you figure out what next Thursday's date is, and you look for a session by me on microfinance, and you'll get Or I'll probably reference it Monday night as well when I talk about ecumenical life. I mean, I'm all over it, but don't start me or you'll miss lunch.
Some of the charities probably St. Mark there is doing this too, along with feeding people, you set up counseling sessions to try to get them in a better position in our interfaith housing program. We're proud that we get people out of there in a few weeks with their own job, with a better education, with a better understanding of life, a better attitude, a home. That's our goal. Our goal isn't to just give them a place to sleep that night.
Thank you. And look at Bread for the World. A tremendous advocacy resource, changing public policy. We need both. We need to take care of the hungry today because it isn't entirely their fault that they're in that situation. I mean, to go to the default thing, I'm sorry, you can open that door, because that's a very complicated one. I'll take back what I said. But the point is, there are needs that we should be compassionate to. Kieser says, at the end of the day, those of us who stood by and said, "Oh, I'm not gonna salve my conscience, you know, by doing good." At the end of the day, it'll be the do-gooders that really haunt us when we're on our deathbed, or just after we die. He says, not the. The programs I like, the charitable programs I like, are the ones that are the most multifaceted, the ones that. Where people started with a program and they said, you know, this isn't enough. We need to also be doing that, and we also need to be doing that. Right down the hill from the big and mighty St. Mark's is a tiny little Lutheran church. I'll do my penance for being a bad Lutheran now. Lift up a tiny little Lutheran church that has a food bank, and it has a hygiene center, so it offers showers to people living on the streets. And it's got a long-term recovery center where they take, like, 3 or 4 or 5 men at a time and give them transitional housing and counseling over the course of a year. People that have gotten sober and clean, you know, and are willing to, but need the transition back into, it doesn't just give them an apartment, it doesn't work. You know, you need to stand, walk with them for a while. I love that little program for its multifacetedness. And for those of you at St. Mark's, they are one of the recipients of our
home. St. Mark's and Salem, some of us have taken individuals into our home at some risk and worked with them individually, one-on-one, like they were your son or daughter.
Huge. Kieser starts off successful and sometimes not.
You're highly abused.
Kieser says he's the bleeding heart type who can't say no to anybody. And he opens the book with the story of a young woman who had mooched him for years, up and down, and driven him crazy. And how she ended up killing herself in a campground, and the police found his name on among her things, and so they called him up, and he's a pastor in Vermont. And I said, "You know anything about this woman?" And so he says, "You know." And then he wrestles in a very personal, self-revealing way with, did I help her or not? Why did I do what I did?
I have something that keeps occurring to me through your whole talk is our being able to see our own judgment. It's the thing I struggle with the most, that when we help somebody, it's really hard to see the judgment. And I have a brother who I hadn't seen in 7 years at one point, and he'd become homeless. And I was walking into Whole Foods, and I walked past a man who's a Vietnam vet and plays a guitar and drives me nuts, and I was like, oh, he irritates me. And then I saw my brother and did a double take, and he said my name. And I sat down and talked to him and bought him a sandwich, whatever. And as I was leaving, by the time I passed this man who was playing the guitar, I was sobbing. And he looked up and said, I hope your day goes better. Mm. And it's changed my whole world. That because right before he said it, my thought was, I wish that was my brother. Because he was so much more functional than my brother is. Mm. And it's changed the way I look at people.
Yep. The worst, Kieser, the worst grief of our lives is the discovery that we are unable to help the people we love the most. not when love is unrequited, but when it proves insufficient. That's what breaks our hearts. Thank you for exposing your own heartbreak. Yeah, and in a way, the charitable, responding to the charitable impulse, which will make us feel good, and that's all right, you know? Good sex makes us feel good, and that's all right too. It's just not the end of it all. It draws us into relationships. Your experience, and as long as we stay authentic and we are listening to the people, they're not voiceless objects. I can't, you know, when I was running that charity, the people who didn't really want a lot of contact with our clients, because it was easier for them to believe greater things about their help. If they didn't have the contact, that's when charity is dangerous and deluding. So, what a treat to work on this with you.
That brings up a point we haven't touched on. Besides being a distraction, charity can be a distraction, besides having unintended moral consequences, besides the moral hazard, besides the possibility of subjugating people, the other piece that we've missed is that our self-righteousness can also destroy people's dignity.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned that, but that is another danger. Kaiser goes into that.
And sometimes the only way a potential recipient of our good intentions can protect their dignity is to refuse services.
Exactly. Steve Biko, the reason he offended the white liberals so much is that this is a wonderful history. I'll go into it a week from today. Biko started, he was one of the good black leaders who participated in the multiracial organizations among the English-speaking whites. And it was in the course of working there that he realized that this is not helping us. And his Black Consciousness Movement said, we blacks are going to withdraw over here. And the white liberals are saying, wait a minute, that's apartheid, don't go there. That's going to make the Afrikaners happy. Which it did, which gave them a little breathing space, and that's how the movement got started, until it was so strong that the government couldn't suppress it. Biko said, there's a white superiority complex here that doesn't let me be who I want to be in multiracial circles. And there's a black inferiority complex operative in the country. You can translate this to any other arena. Some people with a superiority complex, some people with an inferiority complex. Biko said the withdrawal of blacks into all black caucuses, or women into women's caucuses, he said, is a temporary measure for us to recover our sense of dignity about who we are and what we can do for ourselves, so that when we are in mixed situations, we aren't dominated. He saw it as a temporary measure. The white liberals were panicked.
To bring it right home to our communities, there's homelessness in every one of our communities. And a significant percentage of the people who are homeless have diagnosable mental illness. And some studies have been done attempting to reach those people who are basically avoiding services. Refusing and avoiding. And the work has shown that the greatest success comes from long and extended development of bonding and trust with those people to help give them the confidence to come into services.
Can I speak up once again? Once more, and then we will break for lunch.
But
to
please
respond to that, my brother is not crazy enough to qualify for services. He's gone for help many times, and he's not sane enough to do like Salvation Army. He can't do it, so he falls between the cracks. Mm-hmm.
Which is why the agencies that want to help have got to have lots of different levels for lots of different people. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being interested in improving the health.